Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, and artists that make up and inspire the Black Hill Press family. Black Hill Press is dedicated to the novella. We believe a great story is never defined by its length. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How, the Why, brought to you by Black Hill Press and 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Nathan Gonzalez, the founding publisher of Nortia Press. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I introduced you as the founding publisher of Nortia Press, but you are so much more than that. You are a professor. You have a PhD. You speak on Middle East politics, and it's pretty amazing, like looking up everything that you've done. But let's start off by talking about Nortia. How did it all come about, and what was the impetus for starting this press?
Yeah, the impetus, it kind of came about by accident. I was a writer. I wrote my first book when I was finishing my master's program. It was a book on U.S.-Iranian relations, and after that I pitched a second book to a different press, and everything was going well, but the press was having some cash flow problems and some management problems, and they were not giving me my advance. I said, okay, well, give me some free copies and forget about the advance. And they said no, which I was shocked, you know. I had always sort of had, you know, like all authors have problems with their press. I mean, it's like a natural state of affairs that you're going to think they're not doing a good enough job. But I thought this was too much. I thought in a very sort of arrogant way, I can do this myself. I can be a publisher. I can publish my own book. So I took my rights back, and I started to publish, went ahead to publish my book. And then I realized that without a distributor, you can't do anything. And so I clamored to try to find a distributor, and, you know, with the sole purpose of publishing my book. But then I thought, well, these distributors want you to publish more than one book.
Right.
So I said, okay, I'm going to become a publisher then. And publish other people's books too, so that I can publish my book. It was kind of a strange thing. And so by sheer luck, this really, really important distributor took me on, took a chance with me. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm a distributor. I'm a publisher now, a real publisher. And so I sort of forgot about my book, and I just started focusing on building this thing that I had been a copy editor for 10 years. I had sort of designed, I'd self-published a novella when I was, you know, a teenager. And so I knew how to sort of, I knew the mechanics of it. And by creating my own book, I learned the software and everything. So I thought, I can do this. Again, in a very arrogant way, I thought I could do it easily. And that's sort of how it started. The impetus that we have is the mission statement is that we're about global affairs, but it kind of that mission statement was kind of suggested to me by the distributor that said, "Hey, your books tend to relate to global affairs. Why don't you call yourself a global affairs publisher?" And I said, "Yeah, you're right. That's what I do. I study international relations."
Right. You know? So how did you find your authors at the beginning? And were you expecting to focus more on like nonfiction, like your book, or were you open to anything at the time?
I was open to anything. I imagined nonfiction, but because the beginning, nobody knew me. And so the beginning was through personal contacts, authors that I knew through being an author and through being in academia. And, you know, one guy was like, hey, I have a novel. you know, about Korea. And I had pitched him I had asked him to work on a nonfiction book for me. And he pitched me this great, really cool story about Korea. So the, you know, U.S. military guy in Korea was kind of half autobiographical. And so I said, well, that's cool. You know, it's global affairs too, so let's do it. And so historical fiction very quickly became a thing. And I very quickly learned sort of the value of historical fiction as a teaching tool as well. And so it sort of made sense that we, you know, focused on global affairs, both fiction and nonfiction, and sort of the span, you know, reach a wider sort of audience, but also sort of get into the issues on a more deep level, because there are things you can say in fiction that you can't say with nonfiction. You know?
Right. So you said, how old is the press at this time?
I got my distributor in 2011.
Okay.
So that's when I officially started. My official start date is February 2011.
So now you've been around for 5 years, 4 years, and how are you finding your new books? Are you soliciting authors, or are people submitting to you?
We accept authors through our acquisitions process. We have an acquisitions email, and I would say the majority of the authors have found through that, through just them reaching out to us. But I do have people that I reach out to that I know personally and who reach out to me through personal contacts, and things happen that way, you know? So it's a mix.
Do you have a preference? Like, you know, I'm looking at all of your titles now, and it is, you know, you definitely have this global affairs, and even your fiction definitely have like a sense of place and a sense of time, you know, like you said, a historic nonfiction. But do you have a preference of what you want to see more of with your press, more of the nonfiction global affair pieces, or these historical fiction?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that fiction is harder to publish, in the sense that if you're a new author, you could have an amazing novel and nobody buys it. And if nobody buys it, then you can't sustain that kind of thing. Some of the best sort of publishers that do fiction, like indie fiction, are nonprofit organizations that get outside money to support their efforts. And they're able to do that in a way that we can. We're not a nonprofit organization. So and even if we were, you know, you'd still need the outside somebody to put money into it. The way that my criteria is, and not every novel I've done is nonfiction, is related to global affairs. I have a couple, and I'll give you an example. Found Objects by Peter Gelfin is one of my favorite novels I've ever read, and it's one that I was lucky enough to publish. And it's not related to global affairs. It's about a photographer, and there's sort of a, you know, a polyamorous relationship. But I fell in love with that book so intensely that I said, I don't care if it's not global affairs. I don't care if it's fiction. I don't care if he's not a well-known author. I need to publish this.
Right.
Because I'm lucky to have this in my hand right now. I need to do something with it. And I published it. And so the criteria, I guess, to answer your question about fiction is I have to absolutely love it. And I have to love it enough that even if I were to lose money on it, I would still be proud to have published it.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, how do you go about publicizing and getting your works out to the community? I mean, I've seen that a lot of your works a lot of these books have some great write-ups. Now, is this the authors themselves that are getting their work out, or are you working as a publicist as well?
It's a collaborative effort. I mean, a lot of the work is done by Cheryl, who does our marketing. We have worked with some publicists that we've hired. I know one publicist, one of the authors hired. And publicity is it's more art than science and more luck than anything.
Mm.
So we try to do the best we can with the tried and true methods, but also try to find alternative, you know, avenues for publicity that maybe we wouldn't have thought about except for, you know, having had these extended conversations with authors that sort of yield some interesting sort of ideas. The authors, obviously, as you know, drive a lot of the process because we have several books and, you know, it's just me and Cheryl running the press. But the author, that's their book, you know, so that's the one book they're working on. So
right.
A lot of that is for them to go out and sort of think of ideas and suggest ideas to us and see where we go with it.
And you said it's just you and Cheryl, so everything that happens with this press is just done between the two of you. So are you the one who edits everything? You both of the two of you?
Yes and no. I mean, we outsource some things. Like we hire some people, some freelancers to do work, especially, you know, editing and, you know, some of the design aspects of it, of the book process. I can do everything, you know, in the sense that I'm not saying I can do it well, but I can do everything.
Right, you're capable of it. Yeah.
I'm capable of it, even if it's poorly done. But we, you know, whenever possible, you know, we bring freelancers in to help out to do a better job than we would do on the production level side of it. But, you know, the way that book publishing is, you know, from the beginning, sort of I had two missions, okay? So Global Affairs was a sort of, it's like the mission statement that I told you I kind of fell into, but my real desire with this press, one of them was to learn how to publish books without losing money.
Mm.
Because publishers lose money all the time, and that's why nonprofits that have foundational support have a leg up in this industry, because they can focus on the merits of the work rather than on making money. But from the beginning, I thought I didn't want to become a fundraiser, and I wanted full control of the press. Again, arrogance here, okay? And so I didn't want to bring a board of directors, which is necessary to do a nonprofit corporation. So I did
right.
a for-profit corporation, and I said, I'm the only person in charge, and if I fuck it up, it's on me, you know? And so that meant learning how to not lose money on books, and that meant doing most of it myself, doing fewer books, but do more of the work myself, and that allows for us to have a reasonable book budget for these books. And so that's the sort of the challenge of how to make money in publishing, how to not lose a lot of money in publishing. The other sort of mission that I had that I don't write on my website, but it's the sort of the value system of the website of the press is something I called Authors First. Having been an author myself, and I don't mention this to authors or to anybody. I mean, you're one of the first people I tell this to, but
mm-hmm.
Authors First drives everything, right? So the goal was, if you can make authors happy with the idea, then things will be better, right? The publisher will be more successful, money will come in, I'll be happier, and everybody will be. So that was my idea, right? Authors First. And that means listening to authors if they have ideas, giving them maybe not official veto power on the contract, but practical veto power over things like cover and text design and things like that. Because it's their work, you know.
Mm.
So try to make sure that they're valued as collaborators in the process, which larger presses can't always afford to do or don't have the corporate culture to do it that way. I haven't always sort of lived up to it, you know, especially last year when I had too many commitments and I let down authors on a lot of things in terms of timing of releases and all that stuff. But that's the sort of core focus of what I think makes the press sustainable, is
right.
this Authors First thing.
Now, how do you find time. I mean, like I mentioned before, you're a professor at Cal State Long Beach, and you. That, I mean, that in and of itself seems like it would take up a lot of your time. But then you're also running this press, and you're also giving talks on TV and radio, and it seems like. How do you manage your time?
Well, I think that I don't always manage it well. I mean, that's the truth. I've started to cut back on teaching so that I can, now that the publisher is doing better and I've gotten the flow of it, the hang of it, I'm able to cut back on teaching and focus more on this. I finished my PhD in December, so that's out of the way. That's the practical thing, but the real way that I handle this is by seeing everything as being part of the same thing, right? So
right.
I see my teaching, publishing, writing, all of that being part of the same sort of individual, personal sort of contribution to society, which is the dissemination of knowledge.
Right. Different things
so
in the same hands.
Yeah, so it's just it's different tasks trying to accomplish the same thing, and so in that sense, I don't see them as competing with each other.
Right. You went to school for you got your master's in international affairs, and you studied and wrote your two books on Middle East politics. What brought you? Because that's the foundation of everything that you've done, the press,
mm-hmm.
everything. What was it that brought you to intrigued you about Middle East politics?
Well, first of all, growing up in Southern California, growing up around Iranian Americans, they're one of the, one of the largest demographics here, like Latinos, like I am. And so there was a genuine interest in their culture. And then I was an undergraduate when September 11th happened. And before we started, you had mentioned to me that you had your novella deals with, a coming of age story around 9/11, right?
Right.
That, as you know, for our generation, that had a huge impact. And so I always interested in, I used to be a music major. And
I listened to some of your compositions. They're beautiful, by the way.
Oh, thanks. That's
yeah.
Nice of you. I mean, now I changed my major to political science as an undergrad. And when 9/11 happened, I always knew the Middle East was important, but that really refocused my attention on the Middle East. And I became fascinated not only with the politics, but also the culture of the region. And so I've been back several times, and I've had the chance to travel there. I just came back from another trip. I'm working on another book on the Middle East right now. And I've just been intrigued by the politics of it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I feel, especially I grew up in California as well. So in my book, we're pretty removed from the actual events. We weren't in DC, so we just watched it. But I mean, that did have such a huge impact, and it did really like bring to light this world, and I don't know if this was your experience, but like it started painting this picture of an enemy that, in my opinion, I didn't know. I don't want to get too political on this podcast, but I didn't feel, I felt like we were demonizing an entire region and, with our media at the time. And I wonder if that was one of the sparks for you to be like, well, no, I need to study more about this and learn about this culture and people, because they're not the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, I was already sort of, aware enough, like you, Bert, to know that the way that the media was portraying the events, and the way that the Bush administration was linking Iraq from the very beginning to 9/11, when we knew that they were not linked to 9/11, you know, that really had an impact for me. The bigger event for me even was the invasion of Iraq, which I'm still very pissed off about. You know,
oh, yeah.
I mean, I have friends who have, you know, been affected by that, who fought over there. It's
no,
just
still,
one of those
we're
things.
We're still seeing the ramifications of
oh, yeah,
that
I mean,
blunder.
Yeah, ISIS. Everything that's wrong. I mean, so many of the things that are wrong. The Middle East has never been this bad, and I'm including like ancient history, you know. So it's bad, and we created a lot of the bad that's there now. And so I have a lot of resentment, like you probably do, about the Iraq War, and about sort of what it means for in the context of American history, and what it means in the context of global history. So those moments were pivotal, and it just makes you want to learn more, you know?
Right. But does that color, like, the type of works that you want to publish with Northia? I mean, I'm assuming that you, based on what I've read about the books that you released, that they definitely are charged with getting information out, not pushing an agenda, but just giving, like you said, giving knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of our authors, Megan Sayers, does a lot of, and you might have been thinking about this when you're saying that, she does a lot of great work on cultural understanding, and she's traveled to the Middle East a lot, Turkey, Iran, and stuff, and she brings a lot of that into her work, into her young adult novels, and into her nonfiction work. On sort of cultural diplomacy. And, you know, part of it is those are the people that I have gravitated toward me and vice versa. But I want to make clear that I don't have a filter for the press. Like if right-wing conservatives approached me with a book that I thought was good, a good
mm-hmm.
book, objectively, I would publish it. So I am not, the press doesn't have an ideological mission, even though I do tend to gravitate towards certain things and people seek me out who are interested in certain things that I am. But that is not the, sort of the, because there are some presses that are clearly progressive or clearly about, one angle or another, but that was never the intention, and that will never be the intention.
Right. Right. No, it's just about getting knowledge out there. It
exactly.
doesn't have to be one left or right. It's just knowledge.
Exactly.
Now, Nathan, we do a project with Black Hill Press in 1888 called Routinology. We just started it at the beginning of this year, where we talk about an artist's routine, about what they need to, you know, get into the mode of writing. And, you know, we talked a little bit about managing time, but would you mind giving us a little bit about what your routine is when you sit down with your book? Obviously, everything that you've written is highly, oh my goodness, my brain is not working right now. Like you've highly researched but maybe you could just talk a little bit about what you do, how you work, and what your routine is.
Yeah, I mean, it really, but I have to start to think about it, because a lot of it just happens in terms of sitting in front of my laptop, whether it be at home or, you know, at an office or at a coffee shop. What I try to do is I try to set a time, you know, ahead of time with a schedule, you know, because mm-hmm. when you try to do a lot of things, it's impossible to do it without a schedule. And that sort of creates blocks of time. I will sort of give myself X number of hours to do something. And so in the morning, I'll wake up and I'll usually hang out with my daughter in the morning, just two, and we play and all that stuff. And then when it's time to go work, I'll, you know, I'll have maybe 3-4 hours and just work very intensely and then be finished with work. So, when it comes to writing, that's very different from the publishing side of things,
right.
because in the publishing things, I allow myself to be distracted. to have interference from other things so that I don't neglect things that are urgent. But when it comes to writing, I usually prefer to go to the library. It's a very quiet place, and I give myself even more time to kind of get into it and start the writing process. And you know, it's hard to sort of look at myself objectively, and because I haven't thought about exactly what I don't have a routine, I guess, to answer your question. I schedule myself at random hours throughout the day, and I schedule sort of breaks at random hours throughout the day. So I don't have anything like a
that you need on a regular basis. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I need a full stomach. I need coffee, and I need relative quiet. You know.
But I imagine, you know, especially since you just finished your doctoral program, that you write like a student. You know, where you do your deadlines were the deadline for your dissertation. Because your new book is your dissertation, correct?
Well, that's another book. So.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the new book is really an update of my finished year conflict book. I just came back from the region, and I'm going to go back in August, and I'm sort of updating it for ISIS and everything else. I was just in Iraq, like in March, and I went to the front lines with ISIS and the fight against ISIS, and I interviewed a really interesting people. And so I want to sort of update it and make it into a better book. The last book was very historical. This is more about what's going on now. The dissertation, what I'm doing is I'm doing it at a slower pace since it's not current events related, and it's something that I'm going to do with a university press, which is going to deal with peer review. So you may not see that book for many years to come, you know?
Mm.
But this other one is much more sort of timely, and that one I plan to finish very soon.
Right. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's fascinating, and, you know, imagine you and I could have a whole other conversation about your experience in the Middle East and everything that's going on now. But I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, and thank you for inviting me. And I mean, I just want to say how amazing it is to have Black Hill Press around and have a presence in Orange County where, you know, I'm at. And it's great what Orange County is sort of going to turn into slowly but surely.
Yeah, well, that's what we're hoping for, especially with 1888, which we just launched as well. Kind of creating the cultural history of Orange itself. But thank you again, and you know, I wish you all the best of luck with everything that you're doing.
All right, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
This has been The How, The Why by Black Hill Press in 1888. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.